This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The Human Rights Campaign has been one of the nation's largest advocacy organizations for LGBT rights for almost 40 years. It's helped win large political battles at the state and national levels. This summer, Alfonso David became its president. He's the first person of color and the first civil rights lawyer to lead the organization. According to the National Center for Transgender Equality, the Trump administration has taken more than 40 anti-LGBT actions so far, affecting livelihoods, removing Obama-era protections, and stripping away nearly a decade of changes. Supporters say this is exactly what HRC was built to fight back against. Polls would suggest opinion is split over the need for new laws to protect LGBT people. Critics say the group is too centrist and not focused enough on transgender rights or on people of color. So how does the group's new president plan to make the next steps toward making the world equitable for everyone? Alfonso David joins us now in the studio. Welcome to 1A.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
We welcome your questions for Alfonso David about the HRC or just about the LGBT rights movement in general. So email us 1A@WAMU.org, comment on our Facebook page, or tweet us at 1A. Alfonso, why did you want this job?
Ooh, big question.
You know, right off the top.
I wanted this job because we are at a point in our history that it is critically important that we protect marginalized groups. Minorities, racial minorities, LGBTQ people, women have been targeted by the Trump and the Pence administration over the past 2.5 years. And it's important that we don't sit on the sidelines, that we understand what is at risk, that our rights that we have secured for years and in some instances for decades are effectively being removed from the books. So for me personally, this was the job of a lifetime, recognizing where we are in our culture, where we are in our movement to secure these rights and protect LGBTQ people.
With regards to your background, I do want to talk more about what HRC is doing and plans to do. But with regards to your background, you have an interesting backstory because you were born in Maryland but raised in Liberia and went through some of Liberia's tougher times. But before we get to that, talk about your upbringing in Liberia.
Sure, sure. I was born in Silver Spring, Maryland.
Right outside D.C.
Right outside in D.C. My parents came to the United States for school. My father originally started at Georgetown University, ended up going to Howard because he couldn't afford continuing going to Georgetown. My mother went to school in Virginia. They had me as a child and then went back to Liberia. My father ran for office, and he was elected as the mayor of Monrovia, which is the capital city in Liberia. My uncle also ran for office, and he was elected president of Liberia. So I lived a privileged existence for several years until 1980, April 1st, 1980, to be specific. And there was a military coup that overturned the democratically elected government. My uncle, William Talbert, was assassinated. My father, Edward David Sr., was arrested and incarcerated because he was the elected mayor at the time, and he sat in prison for 18 months.
How old were you when this happened?
18 months he was in prison. I was 10 years old in April 1st, 1980, and we lived under house arrest. Couldn't leave the house. Couldn't do anything for 18 months. And after he got released from prison, we also remained under house arrest until we left to come back to the United States.
How much as a kid, as a 10-year-old, did you understand about what was going on around you?
You know, I because of that experience, I learned as an adult not to underestimate how quickly children can appreciate their surroundings. For me, I got to understand the value of democracy very quickly. I didn't really fully appreciate what a military coup was, but I knew that our way of life had changed. And I also appreciated that the rules that govern how we lived had changed radically. I went to school every day. I had certain privileges and benefits before that were all removed with one stroke of a pen. And you know, as a 10-year-old kid, I really saw things that I would not want any child to see. I saw, you know, women being raped. I saw heads blown off. I saw people assassinated. And, you know, I had to really think about, at a very young age, what is my purpose? What am I doing? What are we doing? What is the value of democracy? And over time, I got to really, truly appreciate what the answers to those questions are for me.
How did your family talk to you about what was going on, what all of that meant, what it meant for you? Did they try to kind of help you understand it, or were they trying to kind of insulate you from it? Granted, you saw it anyway, but how did they deal with it?
I think my parents, you know, my father was incarcerated at the time, so we had no contact with him. But my mother tried very hard to make sure that we were not more traumatized than we already were. And so although she explained that things were changing and that there was a military coup and we would be safe, but unfortunately several members of our family were still at risk, she tried her best. There were things that I saw that she tried to protect us from. Guards would come at the front door looking to rape the women in the house. And my mother stood at the front door to protect them. And I got to see that. She couldn't protect me from that vision. But I think she tried very hard to make sure that her children were protected and that we were not, you know, more traumatized than we already were just from seeing and hearing things that she couldn't protect us from.
How did your family end up leaving Liberia and coming back to Maryland?
So when my father was released from prison, he went to the U.S. Embassy and he requested asylum. He was initially denied. He went back multiple times, and I believe on one visit indicated that he had children, two children, who were born in the United States. I have four siblings, including me, and two were born in Liberia and two were born here in the U.S. And so we were allowed to leave, and we came to the United States, originally arriving in New York, White Plains, New York specifically, and stayed there for a few months before settling in Baltimore and then Silver Spring, Maryland.
What was growing up in Baltimore like? I mean, granted, you were familiar with Maryland, but now you had gone through this really harrowing experience in Liberia and come back to the U.S. That must have completely flipped your perspective of what life was like being in the U.S.
Alienating, disorientating, shocking. There's one story that I've said to a few friends that I think encapsulates some of my experiences when I came to Baltimore. I would, you know, as young kids, you take a bathroom break, or you have to leave class, or maybe during the lunch hour. And on more than one occasion, kids would rush behind me looking for my tail. Black kids, white kids, Latino kids, looking for my tail. This is in 1985, 86. And I think we have to remember at that point in time, there was very, very little awareness of the continent of Africa. People thought it was a country. And so many people were looking for my tail. And they would say, "You're from Africa. Where's your tail?" That was my experience, one of my experiences in Baltimore, where it was not popular to be from Africa at the time. And thankfully, things are changing. But I think we're still at a point where there's not enough awareness about international and cultural diversity that we need in not only in the U.S., but in the highest places of this land.
What in the hell made them think you had a tail?
"I was from Africa. Where's your tail?" That's what I heard. I don't know. When you look at our educational system over time, when I came to school, I had the privilege of going to private school in Liberia, and then I went to public school for the first time here in the U.S. And, you know, this is not an indictment of any specific public system, but I think at the time, very few people knew about, you know, different parts of the world. And that's all I can attribute it to.
So you compound your experience dealing with African-Americans, dealing with not knowing what it meant to be African. So you're getting that from the outside. And then you begin to go through your own coming out journey on the inside. What was that like in terms of just kind of knowing that eventually someone would know?
So at a very young age, I thought I was different. I didn't understand why I was different. As an example, you know, if I found boys attractive, I thought all other boys found boys attractive. We were just not allowed to say anything. It was supposed to be a secret. And I never, of course, acted on any of that until I was an adult. But coming out for me was a challenge because my father said at a very young age, if any of my children are ever gay, I will disown them.
Apropos of what?
Apropos of learning that another family member, an older family member, had come out. And I think my father wanted to put a marker down that if any of my kids turn out to be gay, they will be faced with being disowned. And so I understood that marker and I prepared for it. And so when I told my father that I was gay, sure enough, he disowned me. It was a difficult and complicated process. But
And I want to know how you dealt with that process, because that speaks to the trajectory that your life and your career took thereafter. And I want to get to that when we continue with Alfonso David, who is the new president of the Human Rights Campaign. We'll get to some of your questions and stories as well. I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A from WAMU and NPR. This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson. We're speaking with Alfonso David, the new president of the Human Rights Campaign, the nation's largest LGBT advocacy group. Plenty to discuss, including the upcoming candidate forum with Democratic presidential hopefuls about LGBT issues. We've got plenty of your questions on that, and we will get to that, but we welcome your questions about other aspects of the LGBT experience, the LGBT rights movement, or maybe if you are an LGBT person, what would you like to see HRC focus on? If you've been involved in the Human Rights Campaign, say, as a volunteer, what's your experience been like? What would you like to see the organization continue to do? What would you like to see it do differently? Comment on our Facebook page, tweet us at 1A, or email 1A@WAMU.org. You became a civil rights attorney in New York, I'm sure shaped at least in part by your growing up experiences. And in New York, you were involved in a number of lawsuits regarding marriage equality, litigation on housing discrimination, immigration, reproductive rights. Talk about how your experience as a civil rights attorney shapes your approach to being the president of HRC.
Sure. I'm deeply proud of the work that I've been able to do over the past few decades working on civil rights issues. I started at Lambda Legal, which is a LGBT civil rights organization. And I, with a number of lawyers, filed a lawsuit in New York seeking to protect and secure the right to marry for LGBTQ people. We won at the trial level and we lost at the highest court in New York, the Court of Appeals. And fast forward a number of years later, I had the privilege of writing the marriage equality law in New York with a number of my colleagues. That's sort of, for me, those bookends reflect how important it is to stand up and protect marginalized groups.
And this marriage equality law was before Obergefell v. Hodges, the Supreme Court decision that legalized gay marriage nationwide.
Correct. So the marriage equality law was in 2011. And the Obergefell case came several years later. And, you know, as a civil rights lawyer, I am reminded every day how important it is to stand up for people that don't have voices. And marginalized groups, whether it be transgender Americans or people that are living without means, whether it be the person who is living with HIV in the South or, you know, kids that are being targeted in schools. We need to make sure that our democracy actually represents and protects all of us. And unfortunately, as we've seen in this administration, it does not. So when I practice civil rights law, when I engage in civil rights advocacy, I do that because I understand the importance of actually protecting the marginalized communities.
Civil rights law, as I've understood it from different civil rights lawyers, can be a tough kind of law to practice. Like, it's not like you're doing mergers and acquisitions law or like tax law. It's not like the most lucrative form of the law. And sometimes civil rights lawyers do it really as a labor of love.
It is a labor of love. There is a responsibility that I feel, a moral responsibility and an obligation to do this work. There are many highs, but there are also many lows.
What was the lowest of the lows?
There have been too many. One of the lows was when we lost the case at the Court of Appeals in New York, when the highest court in New York said there is no fundamental right to marry the person of the same sex. I look at the Equal Protection Clause, and it says equal protection, you know, to all Americans, to all residents, to all people that live in this country. And unfortunately, the court fell differently and said there is no fundamental right for two people of the same sex to marry, but there is a fundamental right to have different sex couples marry. It's inconsistent with the concept of ordered liberty and equality. So that's one of the lows. Another low for me is seeing day in and day out this federal administration attacking LGBTQ people. Donald Trump and Mike Pence have strategically used all three branches of government to attack LGBTQ people. They've used the legislative branch to oppose the Equality Act, which would provide protections to lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, and queer people. They've used the judicial branch. Donald Trump has now advanced 160 anti-equality judges for life on the federal bench. In the executive branch, he is advancing regulations to license discrimination in federal contracting, in adoption. He's banning transgender troops from serving their country. So that for me is one of the lowest points of doing this work, seeing a federal administration that is so direct in opposing equality for LGBT people.
So as the president of HRC, do you feel like you can amplify the kind of work you were doing as a civil rights attorney? Or are you looking at this position as a new kind of work to advance human rights?
A little bit of both. I think we always have to learn from our history. And I think we need to appreciate that where we are now, in some cases, is unique. But we can also learn from where we've been to create opportunities for change. All of the challenges and opportunities that I've seen in my life will be used as tools to help us advance a new strategy and a new paradigm for equality.
Worth noting, by the way, the decision Obergefell v. Hodges that did legalize same-sex marriage nationwide did indeed refer to the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Justice Anthony Kennedy wrote the majority decision in 2015 and said that the Due Process Clause and the Equal Protection Clause guaranteed that same-sex couples did indeed have a right to marry. All right, let's talk about directly your work on the HRC and some of the policy priorities that you have. You mentioned the exclusion of transgender troops. Michael emailed, other than the exclusion of transgender persons being able to serve in the military, what is the greatest challenge facing LGBT persons in our country?
The greatest challenge is to have all residents in this country see us as people. Simple. They have to see us as human beings. They have to see us as being entitled to protections, the same protections that they're entitled to. There have been 17 murders of transgender women of color this year alone. 17.
That we know of.
That we know of, exactly. Over the past 5 years, more than 100 transgender women have been killed. Something is going on where we are directly targeting people because of their identity. And I think it's important. The biggest challenge is I want people to see us as people, as human beings, for them to see that our struggles are their struggles, for them to see that the Constitution protects them and protects us. And we can talk about all of these challenges in the LGBTQ, but when you look behind those words, they're real people. And that's what I want people to see.
What's the key to advancing that, to getting everyone to see LGBT people as people?
We tell their stories. We have to tell their stories. There's a reason why Marriage equality is the law of the land. There's a reason why the majority of people that live in this country now say they support marriage equality. There was a point in time they did not. What changed? Visibility. What changed? They were able to actually interface with people that were gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, and queer, and see that they were not aliens. That they actually, when you cut their skin, blood comes out. And I want to make sure that people understand that at its deepest level, at our core, we're the same as they are.
It's funny, you know, Harvey Milk, the San Francisco supervisor who was murdered by another supervisor in the late 70s, once said, you know, if a bullet should enter my brain, let that bullet destroy every closet door. You know, his argument was that coming out is the key to equality, because once there's visibility, everybody knows, like, oh, I know somebody like this, and it advances the cause. It's interesting that in the last few years, there's been more visibility than ever, but there's also been more backlash than ever. How do you deal with that? It almost seems like there's this weird ecological balance in our politics where there can only be so much advance before there's clapback.
Well, I attribute the clapback to the federal administration, specifically Donald Trump and Mike Pence, fueling the flames. For some, it's much easier to live in fear than live in a space of acceptance and love. And if you live in a space of fear, you're told that your status quo will be protected. You're told that the reason why you are not able to get that position that you want is because of the immigrant. You're told that because your taxes are increasing is because of someone else. You're told that because you're not able to access a certain service is because of someone else. The scapegoating that we're seeing from this federal administration is directly is the reason why we're seeing so much hate and chaos and direct targeting of LGBT people and other marginalized communities. But we have a strategy to actually to push back on that. And we have 10 million LGBTQ voters, and we have more than 57 pro-equality voters that are ready and energized to make sure their voices are heard.
I should close the loop. I'm sorry. You mentioned the deaths of a number of trans women of color this year that we know of. What's HRC doing to address that?
Well, I would like to move forward in implementing several different initiatives and plans that you'll be hearing about over the next few weeks to make sure we increase the visibility of this issue. There's a crisis in the transgender community, and many people don't know it. And, you know, I had a conversation with someone a few days ago, and I said to this person who is a trans activist, there's been 17 murders of transgender women of color, but it's not on any of the national televised news stations. Why is that? If there was a crisis affecting other groups, the question is, a rhetorical one, do you think that that would be the case? And the answer is no. Unfortunately, when we talk about intersectionality, this is a key point. Most of the women that are being killed are Black or people of color, and they also happen to be trans. Two categories of identities that unfortunately we've seen over time are not actually well represented in the media. Their stories are not reflected in the press. And certainly their stories are not elevated by this federal administration. In fact, they're targeting them.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. I want to get into some of the public critiques about HRC, and one of them that several of our listeners have expressed has to do with the organization's history of dealing with trans rights issues. Miranda emailed, "I was a very active civil rights attorney in the 2000s. I completely broke with the HRC after it threw the transgender community under the bus for political expediency in the run-up to the unsuccessful Employment Non-Discrimination Act vote in 2007. After that betrayal, I resolved that the HRC will never receive my support." What would you say to Miranda?
I would say to Miranda that, unfortunately, that criticism is not unique to the human rights campaign. The LGBTQ movement, unfortunately, has not been inclusive historically. We've seen that in many different permutations. As a person of color, I can tell you that I didn't feel that my interests were adequately represented by many institutionalized LGBTQ groups in the past. But that doesn't mean that that can't change. I'm the first person of color to hold this position. I'm the first civil rights lawyer to hold this position. So I appreciate that what happened in the past. What I'm focused on is the future. I'm focused on making sure that this organization is thinking about intersectionality, that this organization is identifying priorities that include people of color and the transgender community. And you will see that over the next coming weeks, months, and years.
Is there any particular effort to try to mend some of these fences? I mean, the trans activists that I know are serious about saying, no, really, put us at the front of the line now. And there's no flex. There's no tolerance. It's like, you do this, or not only will we turn our backs on you, we will push you off the cliff because it's our turn now.
Yeah, and I think that's quite appropriate given the history. I did a 10-day tour across this country. I went to Richmond, Virginia, Columbus, Cleveland, Dallas, Los Angeles, San Francisco, Las Vegas, Delaware. I was all over the place. And I had the opportunity to meet with several trans activists. And I can tell you that there's a lot of fear and disillusionment about the movement writ large. And I appreciate that. I don't think that they're wrong. I think they are correct in feeling there's a perception that the movement has not been representing their interests, and that has to change. I'm focused and committed to doing that.
Or frankly, that the movement's ashamed of them and would rather just kind of like say, yeah, they're there, but let's focus on other stuff.
Right. Well, what I would say to that person is look at my track record. In New York, I was responsible for making sure that members of the transgender community could change their birth certificates. And that policy was in place since the 1970s, and I changed that. I was responsible for advancing regulations in New York that allowed the Division of Human Rights to prosecute and investigate cases where transgender individuals were discriminated against. I was responsible for working to make sure that transgender healthcare is respected and protected under New York law. So all they have to do is look at my track record to see that there is a commitment to make sure that the transgender community is respected and represented at the table.
There are also some political critiques of HRC, which were kind of reflected in a comment we got from Don in Warren, Ohio. Here's what he sent us through our app, 1A Vox Pop.
As a gay man and activist who has been an HRC member for decades, I'm afraid I can no longer support them. I've grown tired of watching them endorse milquetoast centrist establishment political candidates instead of the many excellent progressive LGBTQ candidates in every election cycle. They've forgotten that they're supposed to be a progressive organization that aggressively pushes the envelope and moves us forward as a society. I've stopped supporting them financially after the 2018 election, and I will only return if they get back to the progressive advocacy group that they always were and should still be. They've really disappointed me, and I'm done with them for now.
Don, thank you for sharing your thoughts. Alfonso, what would you respond? What would you say in response to Don that it's not progressive enough?
Well, I think we are going through a metamorphosis in our country where we're evaluating what progressive actually means. I think a few years ago, the definition of progressive was very different than it is now. There's a new set of factors that many people look at when they're thinking about who is progressive and whether or not you're progressive enough. And one key factor there is intersectionality, whether or not people are talking about a variety of issues that affect different disadvantaged communities. I don't think that was the case a few years ago. What I'll say to Don is this: I can't take credit or criticism for any decisions that were made in the past. I can say that I'm committed to making sure that the organization is making decisions that identify pro-equality candidates, and that is broadly defined to make sure that all of the interests of our LGBTQ community and the larger marginalized communities are represented. And they will just have to wait and see. Those that unfortunately had bad experiences with the organization will see, I think, over the next few weeks and months that we are taking a more aggressive, progressive position on a number of issues.
One of the things that will allow us to see some of the positions of the Democratic candidates is a forum that the Human Rights Campaign is putting on to deal specifically with LGBTQ issues. We'll talk a bit more about that forum, some of the political advocacy, and some of the candidates that will and will not be attending. We got a question in particular about one candidate. We'll get to that in just a minute. Stay close. Back now to our conversation with Alfonso David, the president of the Human Rights Campaign. Let's get to some more of your questions. Ryan tweeted, LGBTQ youth had over twice the rate of early death among youth experiencing homelessness, are at more than double the risk of homelessness compared to non-LGBTQ peers. What is HRC doing on a policy level to address the needs of these youth?
So the Human Rights Campaign has been working on LGBTQ homeless youth issues for quite some time, working in partnership with other organizations, and we will continue to do that. In many cases, the solutions to these issues are not limited to mental health services. They also include access to housing. And we are going to be working with other not-for-profit organizations as well as our government partners to make sure that we provide services and resources for LGBT homeless youth, but also LGBTQ youth writ large. There are so many challenges that young people face when they come out that we need to make sure that they understand where to go, that the services and the resources are available, and that they're able to take advantage of them.
Ultimately, the reason why LGBTQ youth end up homeless is because of their parents and their families.
That's exactly right.
So what do you do about parents, about their kids, especially parents who are saying, I don't need some lobbyist in D.C. telling me how to raise my children?
Yeah, I mean, I think that is a point and a perspective that I've heard before. I believe that that can change over time with education. You know, we have to appreciate that we live or have lived in a puritanical country for quite some time. And some would suggest that we still do. And we have an obligation and a responsibility to make sure that we educate parents about sexual orientation and gender identity so that they are not throwing their kids out. Are we going to win all of those battles? No. But when we lose those battles, we need to make sure that the resources and the services are available for these kids.
By the way, if you are one of those youth, just FYI, you're listening to two kids who are just like you one of these days. So speaking as two formerly gay kids who are now gay grownups, you are going to be fine. Take a breath. You're going to be fine. One of the other priorities you said you set for the HRC is the passage of the Equality Act. It passed the House in May, doesn't seem to have a pathway at all in the Senate. This would add sexual orientation and gender identity as protected classes under federal non-discrimination laws. What's your strategy for getting this passed, especially because there's basically one roadblock to the Equality Act, and that's Mitch McConnell?
Yes, there is one roadblock, and that's the Senate. We need to make sure that we elect pro-equality senators who will advance this piece of legislation. This is real. In more than 30 states, LGBTQ people can be fired from their jobs simply because they're gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, or queer. LGBTQ people can be thrown out of their apartments. They can be denied housing. They can be denied access to public spaces. And we need to change that. There's an assumption that some have that LGBTQ people are already protected. That's not true. Under federal law, we don't have explicit protections in statute, and we need to make sure that changes.
So it's not just a matter of getting this through the Senate. It's a matter of kind of rebuilding the Senate.
Rebuilding the Senate, absolutely. And also making sure that those that are currently in office understand that the majority of Americans support the Equality Act when they are told what the Equality Act is.
Here's another call we got from one of our listeners. This is what Warren left in our inbox.
Hi, this is Warren Whitlock from Washington, D.C. I just wanted to ask the question as to, you know, what he sees as his three biggest challenges as he takes the helm of this organization.
Warren, good question. Your three biggest challenges as you begin to lead HRC?
I think the first challenge is elevating the existing work so people know what the organization is currently doing. I'll give you a few examples. The organization has a program at historically black colleges and universities. Many people don't know that. And that program is specifically tailored at supporting black LGBTQ youth leaders. The organization has a program on HIV, a fellowship program to identify leaders in the future. We've opened offices in Alabama, Mississippi, and Arkansas to accelerate the pace of progress for LGBT equality in those states. So the first challenge is elevating the great work that the organization is doing and has done so people are aware of some of those opportunities. The second challenge, I would say, is working with all of our coalition partners to make sure that we're standing and standing tall in opposing anti-equality candidates for this election. This will be the election of our lifetime, and we need to make sure that we remove all of the obstacles that we may have in coalition building. And the last I would say is making sure that the voting space is, people can take advantage of it. There are voter suppression laws. There are obstacles that we're seeing in other parts of this country where it is made more difficult for people to simply exercise their constitutional right to vote.
Plenty of questions we got about CNN and the Human Rights Campaign Foundation, which announced last week that they will host a Democratic presidential town hall. It'll be next month in California, focusing on LGBTQ rights. We got a number of questions about this. Let me run through a few of them. Sue tweeted, "Why hasn't HRC invited Bernie Sanders to the CNN LGBTQ town hall? He has always had our backs. Why not include him?" How were the candidates chosen for this?
The candidates that met the threshold for the DNC were invited to participate in the forum.
For the debate, you mean?
For the debate. For the town hall. We anticipate that we'll see more names added to the list before October 10th, but we're inviting candidates based on the DNC criteria.
So it's not that Bernie Sanders was left out. He just hasn't confirmed yet?
Correct.
Lou wrote on our Facebook page, and we got several comments along this line. Lou wrote on our Facebook page, "The CNN HRC town hall focusing on LGBT issues is good news for the GOP. Better for them than the Dems devoting a town hall to Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, Pennsylvania issues."
I disagree. I think we can walk and chew gum at the same time. We have to understand that you have a group of people that are being attacked by a federal administration. And if we elect a Democratic candidate or select a Democratic candidate, we need to understand what his or her or their position is on LGBTQ issues. We can't simply identify a Democratic candidate and assume that they will not only be pro-equality candidates, but they will actually have a plan for addressing some of the major challenges that we see in the LGBTQ community.
I do kind of see where Lou's coming from, though. I mean, granted, it's almost like, on one hand, it's almost like saying there are no LGBT people in Wisconsin, Michigan, Ohio, and Pennsylvania. However, you know, in Wisconsin, not every place is Madison. And in Michigan, not every place is Detroit. And in Ohio, you've got Columbus and you've got Akron. And in Pennsylvania, you've got Philadelphia and you've got Wilkes-Barre. Like, there are parts of these pivotal swing states for Democrats, at least, well, really swing states for everybody, where there are wide differences of opinion on what we should discuss first.
Yes, but I think the hierarchy that, you know, I challenge the structure of the question because it suggests that we should create a hierarchy of issues, and race may be more important than gender. Gender may be more important than sexual orientation. Economics may be more important than housing. I think that's a false paradigm. We understand and should appreciate that the challenges or the interests of certain states differ, but I don't think that we should ignore LGBTQ issues because someone in Wisconsin may be more focused on race or more focused on the economy. We should talk about all issues.
And there are also poor black gay people.
Yes.
Like those do actually exist. We got a lot of comments like what Saren tweeted. Saren asked, "Will HRC endorse Mayor Pete Buttigieg for the Democratic nomination for president?" Basically, we've gotten permutations of will HRC endorse X person for the nomination.
That is looking through a crystal ball. We have an obligation to make sure we engage in due diligence. We will be looking at all of the candidates. Having said that, Mayor Pete Buttigieg's candidacy is historic. And I think it's important to make sure that we have representation at the highest levels of government. But we also have other candidates that are advancing historic candidacies as well. And so we're looking at all of the candidates. We will be evaluating their record and their proposals and their plans, not only on LGBTQ issues, but on all issues that we should care about.
Does being openly gay give Mayor Buttigieg a built-in advantage with HRC?
I don't think so. I think that he certainly brings some new innovative ideas to the table, but I think other candidates do as well. So I don't think we would suggest that someone's sexual orientation is the box that we need to check when we select a candidate, nor do I think we would say because this candidate is a woman or because this candidate is black or because this candidate is from New York. I think we need to look at all of the factors. Again, I think the mayor's candidacy is historic, and that's something that we recognize and certainly appreciate.
I'm Joshua Johnson, and you're listening to 1A. Get to a few more comments before our time is up. We got a call asking about an upcoming Supreme Court case. Here's what Edward left in our inbox.
Edward, rural Virginia, longtime LGBTQ advocate, especially for LGBTQ health. I hope that Mr. Alfonso David in the show tomorrow will courteously define for the audience the terms sex, sexual orientation, gender, gender identity, and stereotype. These are important words for us all to be on the same page about so we can understand clearly what all the issues may be. Also, having read through the amicus briefs in the October 2019 Supreme Court case, Harris Funeral Home, which is going to be about defining some of those terms, it may be very important if Mr. David can comment on that case and how the importance of defining those terms will come through that case.
Edward, I appreciate you sharing that. Just in the interest of brevity, let me just take part of that. Your sex versus your gender. Your sex is your biological, you know, sexual assignment at birth. Your gender is part of your identity. Sexual orientation is your attraction to someone based on the way you perceive their gender. Gender identity is who you see yourself as. Sexual orientation is who you see yourself with. Those are the differences. But with regard to Harris Funeral Home, Alfonso, what's that case about?
So this case is about whether federal laws that prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex also include discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation and gender identity. So as background, there's a federal statute or federal laws that expressly prohibit discrimination on the basis of sex. Over the past 20 years or so, courts have interpreted those federal statutes to also prohibit discrimination based on gender identity and sexual orientation. And the EEOC as well has issued rulings concluding that these federal statutes prohibit discrimination on the basis of sexual orientation as well as gender identity. So the question before the court now is, do you ignore decades of case law that have interpreted federal statutes to include sexual orientation and gender identity or not? And we believe that LGBTQ people should be protected from discrimination under federal law, and those statutes should be applicable.
Let's squeeze in one more quick message from a listener who used our app 1A Vox Pop.
Hi, my name is Preston, and I'm calling from Miami. I identify as a queer person. And I think that ultimately, as far as representation, I think that the Human Rights Campaign has done a very good job of representing LGBTQ people. But as far as most LGBT activists are concerned, I think that the concern lies in how much money HRC makes and spends and where that money goes and into what campaigns or into what salaries that money goes, because I think right now the concern with HRC is about the amount of a capital that they are accruing and where that capital is going.
Preston, thanks for the question. Alfonso?
Our capital generally is reinvested in our communities. We identify candidates that we think are pro-equality, candidates that can protect LGBTQ people, and we support their races. We also have a slew of programs through our foundation program that we launch to make sure that the issues that are affecting the LGBTQ community are addressed. As an example, I recently went to Richmond, Virginia, and identified 27 pro-equality candidates, and we endorse them. We are endorsing them. We're giving them money. We're supporting their races. That's where most of the funding goes. And in addition to that, as I said, foundation programs.
Before I let you go, I don't think anybody is expecting next year to be peaceful. I think we're all kind of bracing for next year to be one loud guttural scream. And culture issues, the so-called culture wars, are going to be a big part of that. Before I let you go, for people who are just gritting their teeth like, oh, God, LGBT issues, I care, but this is just one more divisive thing that I'm going to have to be beaten over the head with for the entire year until November, what would you say to them?
Our lives are at risk. It's as simple as that. If we don't pay attention, if we don't stand up, if we don't speak up, if we don't use our voices, we will see a systemic or systematic erosion of our rights. We're seeing it now. In 2.5 years of this Trump administration, we're seeing our protections rolled back. If we don't stand up and protect marginalized communities, I understand it's not easy. I understand it's hard. But we have a moral obligation to make sure that our Constitution actually means what it says.
Alfonso David is the new president of the Human Rights Campaign. Alfonso, we appreciate your time. Thanks for talking to us.
Thank you.
You'll find the link to subscribe to 1A's podcast online at the1a.org. Also, more information about our team, including today's senior producer, Danielle Knight. Until we meet again, I'm Joshua Johnson. Thanks for your questions and your stories. And as always, thanks for listening. This is 1A.